Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host of the series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. This is a series of conversations I convened in order to invigorate the level of consideration that's taking place at the leading edge of consciousness and culture by asking what I think is the most critical question of our times and examining it from every possible perspective. And that question from the beginning of this series has been, how can higher human consciousness play a meaningful role in helping human beings rise to meet the urgent challenges of our time to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? So this is one of a whole series of in-depth living conversations on this topic with many of today's thought leaders and spiritual teachers, and you can access them by registering for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, I'm joined by Diane Musho Hamilton, and we'll be deepening that discussion from a new direction in a conversation we've entitled, What Makes Everything Workable? Exploring the Edge of Human Conflict, Communication, and Connection. So I'll introduce Diane, we'll spend about an hour in dialogue, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about the last half hour taking your questions. So I expect we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Diane Musho Hamilton is an exceptionally gifted mediator, a group facilitator, and one of the authentic contemporary spiritual teachers of our time. As a mediator, she's well known as an innovator in dialogues, especially conversations about culture, religion, race, and gender relations. She was the first director of the Office of Alternative Dispute Resolution for the Utah Judiciary, and she's received several prestigious awards for her mediation work. She's also been a practitioner of meditation for almost 30 years. She began her studies at Naropa University in 1983 with Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and became a Zen student of Genpo Roshi's in 1997. In 2003, she received ordination as a Zen monk with her husband, Michael Zimmerman, and received Dharma transmission from Genpo Roshi in 2006. Diane facilitates Big Mind, Big Heart, which he developed and has worked with Ken Wilber and me at the Integral Institute since 2004. And what I especially appreciate about Diane is that in addition to having a very spacious consciousness and being all the things I just said, she's whip smart, disarming, and funny as heck. She's also an old friend, a close colleague, and someone with whom I do a great deal of informal dialoguing about important ideas, feelings, and how we can serve best. So, hi, Diane. Welcome. I'm really excited to dig into all this with you.
Hi, Terry. Hello. Thank you. Thank you for those beautiful compliments. I'm not sure I deserve them, but I do appreciate them. It's great to be on the line with you. I always enjoy our conversations together.
Great. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. Both independently and together, we've been writing about intersubjective practice, and then together we've been talking about it as we prepare for the Integral Living Room event we're going to be doing at the end of next month. So, intersubjectivity is in the air on all kinds of levels, and probably it would be good to begin by giving you a chance to lay out some of the key ideas that you are placing at the center of this new book I'm so excited to read, Everything is Workable.
Yeah, the title is a book of mine, my first published publication that'll be coming out in December from Shambhala, and the title "Everything is Workable" is a quote from Chögyam Trungpa, the Tibetan meditation master who founded Naropa Institute. He basically said, "Whatever arises in the confused mind is regarded as the path. Everything is workable." It's a fearless proclamation. He called it the lion's roar, you know, this sort of basic attitude towards whatever comes up in our life, that it's, you know, it's something we can work with. And I think for me, having been both, you know, born and raised and being something of what you might call a fighting spirit, you know, just having a something of a feisty nature, and you know, we all have a certain kind of response towards conflict, and some of us move away and some of us move around and some of us move toward, and I tend to be one of those people that tends to go toward the heat. And at the same time, I've had a meditation practice, as you know, for 30 years or so, and so I was noticing how the, you know, mediate and meditator basically have the same root, and they both imply bringing the two into one. So on the one hand, when we sit down on the cushion, what we're doing is we're taking the division in the mind, and we're basically bringing body and mind into one kind of continuous whole. And to mediate is the same thing, to bring kind of, you know, diverse opinions or different perspectives or contention into harmony. So it's the same gesture, but it's a very different orientation. One happens in our own interior, and the other one happens, as you said just a minute ago, in what we around the integral world talk about as the we space. You know, what happens in the inner subjective or between us, and is it possible to bring to learn how to use methods and techniques to kind of bring the same sort of enlivenment and harmony to our relationships as we do on the cushion. And in my background is, you know, as a conflict resolution professional, there's a certain skill set, and then as a mediator. And I thought it might be nice to start to kind of weave those two together. So that's really what the purpose of my book is to try to create a conversation that engages the discipline of meditation, the insights from meditation, and also then working with the sort of just really basic skills that people can learn to help navigate their personal conflicts and hopefully contribute to larger resolution. So that's the kind of basic background.
Okay, great. Well, that's an overview of it, but as you get into it, you know, the thing that intrigues me about it is everybody really around us, it's one of the great themes that's up in the integral space, is we're exploring the possibilities of intersubjectivity, and we're curious about it. And
yeah,
mostly people are interested in the harmonies, in the deep levels of resonance we can have with one another. And you're kind of taking the opposite tack and saying, well, look, let's look at conflict and look at what can be learned there, and look at it as a path, as a source of practice, as a practice, because heck, we can't avoid a certain amount of it. And you know, I think there's the obvious level that everybody's aware of. We kind of try to be good communicators. We try to practice with our own emotional reactions to other people and so forth. But you've tried to look into it, you know, more deeply than just that surface level. And I'm curious about some of the insights that you think are going to be most useful as we explore the enrichment of this intersubjective space altogether.
Well, I think one of the reasons that I'm kind of approaching it from a slightly different angle, as you're pointing out, is because in the work that I've done in the consciousness world and in the worlds of people doing meditation and spiritual practice, there's such a huge value put on peacefulness that sometimes that peace is not actually deeply authentic, or sometimes it becomes more of an attitude or a certain kind of style that people put on, where in fact the conflicts, even the minor ones, get kind of driven into the background, and people don't necessarily have the skills to know how to approach the conflict. One of the things that I say in the book that I think is important is that you can relate to conflict a little bit like you do a dream, in the sense that there's an interesting intelligence. Whenever a conflict is arising, you know, there is both something happening that can be looked at with interest, like what is at stake, what are the values that are at play. There's also a lot of energy in conflict, where if you go towards it and you work with it, you can capture some of the life force, as opposed to trying to keep everything always harmonious. And you know, we have very different backgrounds in terms of the cultures we come from and how much conflict the cultures will tolerate, how much our families tolerate it, how much we personally prefer, don't prefer. So I'm trying to kind of open up the landscape a little bit, saying rather than kind of this imposed serenity, what would happen if we let ourselves feel a little bit ruffled and move towards conflict with an attitude of inquiry? And in order to do that, you know, you have to be able to actually face the tension that's so deep in our hard wiring. You know, as soon as we start to feel any kind of, you know, that something's getting contentious, there's all kinds of strategies we have for calming things down. Because, as you know, human beings are massively dangerous to each other. So those sensations in our body are actually really wise and really smart. But we can't really begin to work with conflict creatively until we can make peace with those, the kind of anxiety that runs through our nervous system as soon as conflict starts to erupt. So befriending those sensations is really fundamental, and changing our attitude toward the conflict. In other words, it's not bad, it's not wrong, it's actually natural, and something curious and important is happening. But that's a big shift in attitude. You know, it takes a lot to get interested in that way. So that's sort of the fundamental premise before I get to more detail around, you know, how to actually work with it.
Well, that's great. You know, that premise is unassailable, but then the hard part is when you try to pick up on that invitation. That sounds like a very elegant, very wise, very spacious invitation. Okay, so I respond to that invitation, and pretty soon I'm face-to-face with my pulse speeding, and we're off to the races. So I'm curious to ask the follow-up question, which is sort of doesn't even need to be asked. Let's lean in. You know, there are probably multiple lessons and specific examples, but there may be a story or two or some key takeaways that you could share with us that can help whet our appetite to read the full book, and also help us explore what this means, even to trying to come together in a way that brings about higher harmonies.
The potential creativity that's available when we actually go towards it instead of kind of smoothing things out kind of immediately. So one thing that maybe people can consider who are on the line right now, there's sort of it's interesting, there's a parallel between in the Buddhist tradition between the research that's been done on conflict styles and also what we talk about as the three poisons. So there's sort of three basic styles that we have of dealing with conflict. There are those of us who are avoidant. We tend to want to, at all costs, you know, sort of just move away from it. There are those of us in conflict who are more accommodating, meaning that when something comes up, we'll adapt in order to please or to support or to, you know, what's that word? Placate, perhaps, someone. So there's an avoidant style, there's an accommodating style, and then there's a competitive style. There are those of us who are actually get a little bit more interested in moving towards the conflict. And so what I'm interested in asking people to do is just think for a minute about what your basic style is. Do you generally try to just move around it? Are you willing to kind of give a few things up when a conflict arises? Do you find yourself being the more accommodating person? Or are you someone who is actually willing to let the conflict escalate a little bit just to, and in fact, maybe hope that you're going to prevail? And what's important is that we learn how to do all three of those instead of being stuck in one pattern. Right. So, for instance, I'm thinking about a kind of a conflict that I'm having right now with a friend of mine, and we're working on a creative project together. And my style, of course, is to always go towards it. It's to always talk about it. It's always to, like, try to get it out on the table. Right. Her style is much more to kind of just avoid any potential moments of contention. And so the two of us are sort of agreeing right now in our work together that I will do a little bit more avoiding and just letting things go and not necessarily needing to talk things out. And she's kind of making an agreement with me that she'll raise things more often because it's just simply not what she does. And that way, you know, we'll have more range in terms of how we're actually dealing with the issues as they come up. So that's not a very exciting story, but that's just an example of, you know, one of the ways that I'm working with it right now.
Right.
My own life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, while you were doing one of your late rounds of edits on the book, I was writing the paper I presented last month at the third annual Integral Theory Conference. And in it, as you know, because you had a chance to read it, which I really appreciate, you know, I focused on how conversations can catalyze a transformative existential confrontation. And the paper turned into a kind of passionate and intellectually, you know, ambitious exploration of transformative and transformational human communication, including even a short history of we space practices that we've drawn on in the integral community. And as I explored that, one of the things that came forward for me is the sense that, you know, because we are doing all of what we're doing right now, it's kind of a wild paradox. We are so lucky and so blessed. It's as though we're, you know, human evolution has kind of poised us as the maraschino cherry on top of the whipped cream on top of the flaky crust. You know, everything is so refined. I mean, not just the quality of our comfort and life and mobility, but you know, the quality of the ideas, the spiritual practices, the quality of the experimentation, the freedom. You know, we're so not fixed into, bound by rigid structures, and there's so much possibility creatively. And at the same time, you know, species are going extinct right and left. The atmosphere has changed. The weather is unbalanced. But it's not just the environmental level. It's also all the human institutions in the United States and pretty much every country around the world are in crisis in various ways at the same time. This is a meta crisis and therefore a mega crisis. And we clearly are implicated by it, and our contribution to it, you know, we are all participants in this interwoven system that has gotten itself into this spaghetti tangle of karmas that seems to be incredibly stuck and unable to bring foresight and wisdom to our participation, and seems to be on a collision course with disaster. And we are all caring people. Many of us are even politically active, and we may be change agents. We may be participating in initiatives that make some positive contribution. And yet we're in a moment in which an even more dramatic kind of transformation is being asked for by the times we live in, and our conversations tend not to to be able to take that as seriously as is appropriate. And so in my paper, I'm kind of suggesting a much deeper seriousness and a much greater humor about all of that at once. And as you know, I had a chance to talk about all of that with Ken Wilbur on one of the calls we did for the Integral Living Room we're going to be doing later, and you've partaken in that. And I know that you bring some really interesting perspectives to that, and I think particularly from your book, you can add to that conversation. So I'm curious to invite you to comment and maybe talk about how some of your investigation of conflict might add another dimension to everything that comes forward there.
Well, the point that you started out making and that I think I want to kind of repeat right now is just this idea that we've done a lot of, many of us in this conversation, in the consciousness and meditation work, we've done a lot of interior work with ourselves, and yet the challenge is when we start to bring that practice into the collective, we still find ourselves faced with a lot of, you know, sometimes disappointment and sometimes, you know, some sense that we should be able to be doing this better than we actually are, given all the practice that we have. So in some ways, I think that that, you know, working with the intersubjective space and learning how to do things collectively is sort of on the cutting edge of where our real challenges are in terms of consciousness. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if you do the kind of work that I've done with conflict, you see that it does have a kind of transformational nature in that whatever the conflict in our lives right now, whether it happens to be in our marriage or whether it happens to be with our teenage child, or whether it's at work, or whether it's in the social activist movement we're in, or whatever it is, you know, if it's on a, you know, a huge level in terms of, you know, thinking about the United States' role in the world and how we're doing things. There's so many things, fracking in the news, or our use of drones, or whatever it is, that those conflicts in some ways are our opportunity to really work with the really raw transformative energy of life. And this enormous meta crisis that you talk about that we're in right now, that if you've practiced on a personal level and you've worked with your conflicts on a personal level, then when you look out and you see the kind of immense challenges that we're faced with, in a certain way you can take a little bit of the faith or a little bit of the success maybe that you've had in dealing with these things on a personal level or on a small scale, and then imagine that same sort of challenge is happening on a big scale. In other words, the confidence that comes from doing spiritual practice, doing conflict work, engaging in social action, that is simply what it's going to require of all of us to be able to continue to kind of work in really good faith as we're faced with all sorts of shifts in the way we relate to the world. And you know, it's a little bit overwhelming when we start talking about it, which I think is one of the reasons that it's hard to have the kind of conversation you're pointing to, Terry, you know, of wanting it to have depth and lightness, because it's so immense. But, you know, this thing we're going to be doing at the Integral Living Room is we're going to actually be trying to have one of the evenings, we're going to try and have a conversation about the environmental movement or about the environmental crisis, where we actually use transformative principles to work with that particular conversation. In other words, how can we begin to talk about it in a way that actually both recognizes the seriousness and creates a pathway for us to work with it without, you know, just an incredible amount of dread and fear. And so for me, it's linking the personal practice to the collective challenge. It's contacting the confidence I have in our ability to grow and change, the way in which conflict and crisis has always and is always an opportunity for us to grow and change and to learn how to do that together. I mean, that's sort of where it's at for me at this stage. So I want to be with people, talking with people, engaging with people who share my practices and share my worldview, because I feel like I just need the support. You know, it's that kind of time.
Right.
You're one of those people.
Yeah. Well, you know, my stance on this has been really simply to ask the question with urgency and passion and seriousness, with the sense that, in a way, life has given everybody alive right now a big whopper of a Genjo Koan, an impossible question that confounds us and really stretches us, and that we cannot avoid, that we have to find an answer to, that can only be arrived at by transforming our consciousness and transforming ourselves, and that it's a shared question, so it's a shared inquiry, and the process of finding our way to it is something that we, you know, we would like to maybe look away from. There are those of us who are going into the conspiracy mind and the apocalyptic consciousness, of course, and that's quite frequently happening in the world. I shouldn't minimize it, but even more common is kind of a denial and a feeling of, well, you know, we can realize that optimism is appropriate and that we can have a tremendous confidence in the kind of self-correcting and kind of vitality of evolution itself, and that, you know, that kind of alarmist, frenetic kind of orientation isn't healthy and or appropriate. But once we've put away our paranoia and we've decided to orient in an essentially positive way, it's difficult to take the question as seriously as it needs to be taken if we're to engage with it in a really vital way. And that is an internal conflict. I guess I'm maybe talking about conflict too, but it's more like the discomfort and the cognitive dissonance that it brings about, the sense that we want to be part of the solution, but we can't help but be part of the problem.
Yeah, well, we're deeply embedded in it. And you know, the problem and the solution, of course, are always they're always dependent on one another. One doesn't exist without the other. But I think what you're pointing to right now is that the very powerful, you know, intention is really the core of all conscious life. And what you're really talking about is our intention. So there's a whole set of factors, and they're global, and they're collective, and they're postmodern, and they're post-industrial revolution, and they involve technology, and there's all kinds of qualities out there. But the place that maybe we always have to begin whenever we're faced with a challenge is what is fundamentally our intention, because it is at the core of how we evolve and how it is we're going to move and change. So it colors and moves everything we do. And there's a nice story that I write about in the book that comes from a student of mine. And this student was, he's Canadian, and he wanted to see the Northern Lights at the height of summer, and was headed up to the Arctic Circle. And he was driving along the Dempster Highway, this lonely highway, and, you know, gradually it was just a few cars and the occasional logging truck, and then pretty soon, you know, the very occasional logging truck, and pretty soon he was pretty much alone on this highway, and he drove into a valley. And as he drove into this valley, the valley filled up with smoke. There was a forest fire somewhere. And at a certain point, he lost his reference points. He got somehow completely discombobulated, turned around, and was so immersed in the smoke that he didn't know which way the fire was, and he didn't know which way the Arctic Circle was. And he said what was most interesting is that his instincts didn't work for him. He lost his instinctual reference points, and his rational reference points disappeared. So he couldn't make any kind of logical decision. He couldn't go to his mind. He couldn't go to his gut. So the only place he could go was to his heart. And he went to his heart just to feel what his intention was, just what was it he intended. And when he was able to do that, even though without really being able to understand, he made a choice about what direction to go and proceeded. And everything lightened up, interestingly enough. Everything lightened up, and he continued, and it turned out that the Arctic Circle was ahead of him, the fire was behind him. That's the way it turned out. But the point was that his intention really helped him navigate that moment where instinct and rationality weren't available. And so I think the point you're making right now is that faced with the kind of challenges we are, we have to be really, really clear what our intention is. And at a certain level, that intention is the kind of compass that's going to help guide us through all of our decision making. And who knows what the outcomes are going to be, you know, from a purely cosmological point of view. I mean, we're all going to face death, and nothing is permanent. So there's a bad ending in store for all of us, really, at some point. But there's also the possibility of approaching that ending with a tremendous amount of heart. So for me, that's part of the issue, is just the really profound connection to our own intention and the intention of the people that we're working with. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I certainly join you in that. As we feel into that, we're also doing that in the context of having done an awful lot of exploration of how big and spacious and rich and complex and fruitful this place where we meet is. The ways in which we enter into shared higher states, mm-hmm. and how we also may be able to evolve the very structures by which we interact. And you and I had a conversation some time ago where you were reflecting on what's been learned about conflict resolution and negotiation, and we're considering whether that might represent a different kind of growth in this intersubjective space, that we're learning, those of us who are experimenting with group processes where a whole group of people touch into a group mind and enter into an altered state together, where to some degree there is a we that is present that speaks through the individuals, and there's a feeling of entering into a much greater and more profound field that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a higher state, and as students of integral theory, you know, Ken makes this big distinction between higher states and higher structures.
Structures, yeah.
And you were reflecting on whether the higher practices in terms of things like dispute resolution, but even just meeting practices and communication practices that enable a lot more to happen more quickly, enable the kind of group thinking and group problem solving to operate, you know, more effectively in the spirit of we is smarter than me. And I'm curious to hear you elaborate on that a little more.
Yeah, well, wow. I mean, this is what our inquiry is about, this whole question around all the different things that are evolving in terms of the kind of the we space. And you know, we might just start with thinking about really basic skills, like, you know, when we're out and about in the worlds we're in, most of the people, or a vast majority of people that we work with, have somehow learned to become active listeners, which means that they're able to suspend their own perspective for a few minutes, simply receive what somebody else has to say, and then reflect that back to that person. It's a really basic skill, but it just goes really a long way in terms of being able to create mutual understanding. You know, so on the one hand, something as simple as, you know, basic listening skills. We talk about perspectives themselves as being a developmental marker. You know, if I can hold your perspective, hold my own perspective, maybe take an outside or a third person perspective, maybe I can look at our dispute, you know, from a number of different angles. That perspective taking is something that people are getting better at. They're getting better and better at it. You know, we don't just often imagine that there's only one way to see things. Many of us now can see multiple perspectives, and that's sort of starting to emerge. You know, in the literature we have things like just the changes in negotiation theory, where we've, you know, this word win-win, and even though some negotiations people often feel like it's a lose-lose, but the point is that people can talk about a win-win now as opposed to just a zero-sum game from the past, or we can talk about collaborations in which we bring or add value. You know, these are things that have crept into the language. You know, we can join together in ways that where we bring more value to the table. And then you have things like Theory U that has evolved, Otto Scharmer's work, the way that we do creative brainstorming together. And then, you know, moving into what you're talking about, processes where maybe we move beyond the individuals into kind of anticipating like an actual energetic shared space in which the boundaries between you and me are not entirely separate. So we move from kind of individual sharing ideas into maybe more of a meditative space in which we're aware of the fluctuations of consciousness itself, where the we, as you said a few minutes ago, is greater than the I. And then we know that the Quakers have obviously had a practice like that for many years, many generations, and some of indigenous people and do group decision making in that particular way. And so part of what the challenge is for us is to kind of develop a kind of a encyclopedia of methods and learn how and when to use the methods that are most accepted or most helpful to the situation we're in. And, you know, I'm thinking right now about something as sort of innovative and remarkable as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. You know, when South Africa came out of apartheid, the injury that had been done and the number of, you know, atrocities, offenses, you know, the only way South Africa could really even take a step forward was to come up with some way to reconcile itself to the terrible history of apartheid. And they designed this process, and for all of its weaknesses, you know, to sort of ask people to simply tell the truth as a way of freeing themselves from the horrible history really was a massively innovative thing to do. And as I said, tremendous imperfection, but really did create a platform for an entire culture to step beyond history into the future in a much more coherent way. So, I mean, right now, I guess what's happening is, as we're talking, I'm just thinking about all these different methods, all these different emergent properties of consciousness, these different ways we can engage each other, and we need to kind of become really familiar with some of the more user-friendly and the ways that we can actually use different group processes and different methods depending on what we need, you know, what's actually going on and what do we know about how we can structure a we space so that we can have the right conversation, come up with the right options, and generate the best outcomes for what it is we're doing. I mean, I think you saw that. You were following the Wall Street, what was it called?
Occupy
Wall Street. Yeah. Yeah, Occupy was using a lot of these kind of, you know, these more recent WeSpace innovations to do their dialogues, as I recall. Weren't they using like a call and response?
Yes.
Instead of using
a megaphone, right.
Yeah, so they were using some really creative ways of engaging kind of in that public sphere when they were holding the demonstrations that weren't your typical ways of engaging. So I think it's interesting just to kind of look around and see how a lot of this stuff is getting used right now. So those are just a number of things that come to my mind in terms of some of the WeSpace innovations that are happening right now.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I guess as we're talking, I'm feeling how, you know, you're dancing with all of this in a very bright and insightful and rich way and a very agreeable way that makes me feel like invigorating the discourse by, you know, presencing this sense of evolutionary urgency that I feel to evolve it. Because I guess I see that the current state of so many different human conversations is not equal to the task before us. It's as though, as individuals or, you know, even in certain small groups, we are able to operate in an incredibly smart and foresightful way. But when we get together and create our larger human institutions, you know, Congress is at a standstill.
I know it.
You know, the UN is ineffectual. The European Union is ineffectual. The treaty negotiations at the levels of the G8 or the World Trade Organization or you know, at every level, brilliant people who are incredibly accomplished and incredibly high performing are coming together. And while we face issues that are, you know, hugely challenging, we're all stuck. And we're all part of this system. We can't just sit there and point fingers at others and say that there's something missing. Somehow we have to be engaged in an inquiry that has the possibility of changing the game, of unlocking the stuckness. And my own practice, in a sense, is to hold this like a koan, to say, okay, how can I engage in a way that has the potential to break through? What would it take to do that? And so there's a passion in that that is interested to notice the, you know, many distinctions, needs to notice the distinctions, finds all of that relevant and valuable and even delicious, but is recognizing that until we're holding the question at a level that allows it to have an existential impact, so that the conversations we have are so powerful that we emerge from them changed in our way of being, such that we can show up more powerfully in the next situation or encounter, you know, that's they have to be at least that, and ultimately even more powerful. And yet, so often the conversations we have seem to be kind of as if we're in the position of the disconnected observer, and we're talking about it, and we're just interested in it, and we're kind of sitting comfortably on the couch eating popcorn, but we're actually, you know, on the deck of the Titanic. You know, we have to recognize that we're very much implicated as integral scholar practitioners. You know, we have to look at it that way.
Well, what do I really think about that? You know, I mean, it may be when you describe the Congress in a stalemate, which it definitely is, and you talk about the EU not quite being, I mean, it may be that those particular forms are just simply starting to break down. And the question, you know, kind of becomes, you know, what are the new forms that are emerging? I was in a conversation over the weekend, and it's pretty interesting to you know, I'm not sure. I think we can only be where we are. And what I mean by that is there's a cognitive dissonance, because on the one hand, yeah, the news is, and, you know, species are going extinct, climate change is upon us, you know, certainly in the part of the world where I live, you know, that the temperatures do seem to be higher than normal. We're experiencing a lot of wildfires, and the southwest of the United States is definitely one of the places that's going to be most hard hit when these changes start coming about. And at the same time, you know, how many of us are, in this conversation anyway, are facing any sort of real shifts, you know? So I think, you know, how to actually be true to what's most real in the moment, and at the same time be able to anticipate, you know, some real challenges in the future. I think there's a cognitive dissonance there. And so I think I don't just want to be subject to a certain kind of liberal guilt that I need to, you know, somehow take something on that is clearly coming but maybe isn't quite here yet, at least in my world, and certainly not true around the globe. I know that. But for instance, here's an example. So I just happened to be at Thomas Hubel's Celebrate Your Life Festival. One of the people he invited was a well-known person who's doing investment banking in China right now. We had a conversation about China. He said he sat down with one of the party members one evening, and the party member expressed to him that he didn't know how to be a good Chinese citizen and at the same time become a global leader. It's like he felt this sort of conflict, you know, between his loyalty to the Chinese and his loyalty to the world and to the globe, particularly as China becomes the economic power that it is. And, you know, in their conversation, it's clear that the Chinese know that capitalism as we've known it in the West is not ultimately an option because of the incredible devastation with that high population of people, and also already the, you know, the effect on the rivers and on the air in China. They know that they have to find a new way. They just know that. And this party official is wrestling with this idea, you know, how am I loyal to China and loyal to the globe at the same time? And I just happened to present him our, you know, the models we work with of these kind of spiraling worldviews, you know, explained by spiral dynamics or in the developmental research we've been doing, ego to ethno to world to cosmic. And for whatever reason, this framework was incredibly exciting to the person I was talking with. And he actually asked me if I would send him an outline kind of explaining this model, and is just at this very moment translating what I sent to him into Mandarin so he could start sharing it with some of the Chinese officials that he's working with. So I think in a certain way, we have to be able to just be true to the moment. And when there's opportunities to contribute either a model or a framework or a methodology or a way of being in this very moment with that intention that I was talking a few minutes ago about, that clear intention to become a more conscious, heartful, participative being amidst crisis, in a certain way, that's the best we can do, you know, really being available to the opportunity in that moment. I mean, how could I know that this little model that we all work with is going to be really important to this person? But it just so happened that his Chinese colleague asked a question that our map really addressed. So, you know, just kind of being on our toes, and this is why this whole WeSpace question that we're working with, you know, what are the different ways in any one moment that we can support a coming together that might take us into new ways of being? Because I think the old ones simply are breaking down. They're not working in the way that they have. So being creative, following energy, being available to what's new, what's fresh, and I think that's at some level the most we can offer. You know, is kind of like really inhabiting our cosmic address and inhabiting our moment and really paying attention to what in this particular situation can I contribute? What is it that I understand that I'm willing to do? What risks can I take in this conversation? You know, what forms might I suggest so we can go deeper together? You know, how can I participate as fully as possible? So more than that, I really don't know how to do.
Well, I think what you've offered there is beautiful, and I mostly want to kind of, you know, hear, hear, and thank you, and beautiful. But I do think that there's an impulse toward innovating and leading that, you know, arises in me and that can at times make a difference. I don't suggest that I can make, you know, I don't have delusions of grandiose, you know, effect at this time. You know, it's not as if I see a plan where I'm going to impact the stalemate in American politics or international, any of the international institutions I was talking
about. But I really appreciate how much you care about it and how involved you are, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, it does seem that holding the koan seriously with the sense that a source of creativity needs to arise from us and that the potential for proactive leadership does rest with us. I think responsiveness and clarity and spaciousness, as you were articulating them, is mostly what we can do and need to pay attention to. But you were kind of saying that's the most we can do. And I kind of like to say that's the most we usually can do. And we need to kind of keep a burr under our saddle asking something more from us. And if we hold everything you say in that way, then I'm on board.
Well, I want to go back and just include what I said at the very beginning, though, because I think it's even more important, which is to relate to the dissonance, to relate to the challenge, to the conflict, to the crisis that you're describing as precisely the source of energy of the change, that the problem and the solution are one and the same. So to me, that's even more important, that it isn't simply related to if things are going wrong, things are going right, because that's the direction they're going. And it's out of this rich dissonance, this, you know, seeming impossibility that the next wave of whatever is coming is going to come. And that's where, you know, learning how to actually really, really see the confusion and the turmoil as completely innate to the next wave of consciousness. The conflict and the growth are not separate. That's the important point.
Right.
So I want to go back to that from the very beginning. I said that when we first opened up, but right now in this part of the conversation, I think it becomes relevant again. You know, that by shifting our attitude towards it and seeing it as completely 100% necessary in order for us to evolve. In other words, we can't evolve without it. It has to happen.
It's true. You know, I think that the upset that we might feel upon reading about the suffering of people or creatures is it stokes the fire of the motive to practice and to serve and to awaken individually and collectively. and the sense that what we do matters, and that that the pattern energy that is unconscious is, you know, that we can awaken into and bring alive through showing up authentically and intelligently in the moment, you know, needs us, and that sense of that call becomes more acute and more enlivening. And
yeah, and for the listeners, I want to say that being fully available to the moment is radical. Lots of times the issue is that we really aren't awake enough to what actually is happening to make the contribution. So when I say being available to what's coming up, I mean, I really...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal, and there's a challenge in it because we're asleep. We miss plenty of opportunities because we're not awake to what's really going on.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly so.
So I like your challenges, and I like that you're, you know, wanting us to drive a deeper stake in the ground. I mean, I'm on board with that. But at the same time, we have to be fully available to what the actual conditions are of this very moment of our life, like here, right now.
Yeah.
It's all we can do. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I say it's all we can do, and you're saying, no, we need to hold ourselves to, you know, a higher standard. Okay, so it's what we can do, and perhaps there's more. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
Perhaps there's always more.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We're being called to our very best, and we can see this part of our very best, and there's an X factor of a possible very best that can be creative in new ways, and that's really important, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm in agreement with you there. I'm glad we. That's interesting. We just worked that out here in public. Nice one.
Yeah, we had a little conflict, didn't we? Good for us. A little conflict resolution on the spot. And by the way, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, just, you know, how painful it really is when you're in the midst of it. Just for whatever reason, I'm having an image of, you know, when Lincoln was walking among the bodies, you know, after some of the great battles during the Civil War. I mean, what incredible descriptions those are, you know. So this is in no way to be Pollyanna about the great cost to us, you know, of not knowing how to navigate these better than we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. It seems to me that the moment calls upon us for, you know, more in many different ways simultaneously, more spaciousness, more awakeness, more joy, more confidence, more sobriety, more vulnerable empathy and brokenheartedness and compassion and connection to pain and suffering and all the costs. All at once, not one at the cost of another, not to rock to one side of these polarities at the expense of the other, but to become deeper beings, bigger beings, more existentially, profoundly related to all of this. And I feel that challenge, you know, very, very much personally, and I present it to others at times too.
I think Rilke said something really beautiful. I think Rilke said something like, that basically our evolution rests on our willingness to be defeated by greater and greater beings.
Yes, yes, like wrestling with angels. Yeah, exactly. We're always defeated, but defeated at a greater and greater level, kind of. Yeah
right, exactly. The inevitable defeat of our own death. I mean, our whole existence is basically, you know, Leonard Cohen calls it our inevitable defeat. You know, so from that perspective, engaging as fully as possible, realizing that that we're defeated all along the way, and that it results in a great defeat. And that may be true collectively as well, that we will experience a great defeat together.
Well, we have no guarantees. We don't know. Gosh. It's time for the announcements, Diane, despite the fact that I'm ready to keep rocking and rolling. So if you have any questions for Diane or me, please, if you're listening by phone, raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone keypad. And if you're listening online on your computer, please type any question or observation or challenge into the Instant Teleseminar window so we can read it. First, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Diane's work. Her new book, Everything is Workable, A Zen Approach to Conflict Resolution, is now available for pre-order with online booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at Shambhala Publications. It gives you the tools that you need for dynamic, vital, and effective relationships, both personal and professional. It offers a spiritual approach to conflict resolution, providing teachings along with practices and exercises that can be applied to any sort of relationship in which conflict is a factor. And her work in conflict resolution and group facilitation has evolved into a unique approach to facilitation mastery that she teaches in a program called Integral Facilitator. And she's offering the introductory 3-day Next Stage Facilitation Intensive next month on September 13th through 15th in Houston. And that's a prerequisite for the Integral Facilitator Certificate Program, which is going to begin in October. So for more information, you can go to integralfacilitator.com. In October, on the 10th to 13th, women in Utah can join Diane with yogini and kirtan singer Wah for Lotus Lounge, Sexy, Smart, and Spiritual.
We're doing that in Boulder, Terry.
Boulder, in Colorado. Boulder. I'm sorry. Okay, wow, on October 10th to 13th. Yes, it's at the Integral Center, I see. So you can find more there at tazpresents.org/lotus lounge. And for Zen practice with Diane, you can find out more at 2arrowszen.org. And her own website is dianemushohamilton.org. Or .com. dianemushohamilton.com, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I also want you to be aware of my work. Even if you are on the mailing list for Beyond Awakening, you're not necessarily on my personal email list. That's at terrypatton.com. I invite you to go there to show up, to sign up. And there's a particularly rich opportunity to work with me directly coming up next month, September 27th through 29th. I'll be at Esalen in Big Sur leading a retreat, Encountering the Beloved. And that's a place where you can experience some of my most powerful transformational work into the experiential opening of authentic intimacy with the living divine reality, second-person spirituality. I'll be incorporating interpersonal processes, journaling, meditation, prayer, movement, nature communion, and celebration. So it's a wonderful place, obviously, to retreat, restore, and reconnect with nature and God and other open-hearted people, and me. Now, of special interest, though, is an event that Diane and I already mentioned. We're going to be co-facilitating with Jeff Salzman and Ken Wilbur, October 31st through November 3rd in Boulder, the Integral Living Room at the Integral Center there. We have worked together for nearly 10 years now, leading many significant Integral events, including the Integral Institute seminars from 2004 to 2007, the Integral Spiritual Experience events from 2009 to 2012, the What Next Integral Conference held this last New Year's holiday, and earlier this year we asked ourselves what we were most passionate about and what we really wanted to recreate. We decided we really wanted to recreate the best spirit of these past events, this special we space of committed integral evolutionaries, but rebooted for 2013. And we decided we wanted to do it in an intimate human scale and make it affordable and really alive. So it was kind of the gathering we not only wanted to lead, but to attend and enjoy ourselves. So We expect it to be really rich and free-flowing, a gathering of friends that will embrace the spirit of integral living and the question, how can we embody and express the insights into interconnectedness that have inspired us so deeply? So we're not far from the early registration discount deadline, which is August 25th, and you can find more about that at integrallivingroom.com. My website, I guess I didn't give the URL, is terrypatton.com. You can find out more about the events with me and also about working with me individually and of course, getting on my list. Stay tuned. At the end of the question and answer, I'll tell you about our next Beyond Awakening interview. That will be with Kenneth Folk, the Buddhist teacher and founder of Pragmatic Dharma. So let's see what we have in the way of questions. The first question that I see was asked on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Brooke McDonald wrote, I'm in a co-parenting conflict with a high conflict personality type person. I feel constantly off balance. I have a strong desire to be reasonable and to mediate amicably, but this has proved impossible to do. I'm getting better at disengaging from this irrational, conflictual person and holding firm boundaries just to protect myself from abuse. Mm-hmm. But this stance is very much against my nature. And when explaining my situation to friends, I've often joked that by the time my son is 18, I'll either be a stress-ravaged mess or a Zen master. I prefer the Zen master path. Any advice?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the advice I would give is kind of, trying to reframe the maybe a little bit of what the partner is or the former partner, just emotionally intense. You know, sounds like an emotionally intense person, and when there are differences in that approach, you know, just creating good structures makes all the difference, you know. So you say you want to mediate, but there might be some way to do like you're negotiating online, right, or to just go back and forth with a person who conveys messages back and forth. And, I mean, I respect your view of wanting to have more calm in your situation, and you're dealing with this person for whom that's not really possible. So just knowing that, framing it as positively as possible, and then just putting structures in place that actually can maybe create a little bit of distance and protect you from some of the negative energy that you don't want to be subjected to. Sounds a little bit like from what I've already heard, that you're already probably doing that. But I don't think you have to keep kind of putting your body in relationship to that kind of emotional intensity. So look for some structures that will help alleviate that. Often we expect to be able to do things personally when in fact we just need a better strategy. So that's how I would respond to that.
So you tend to deal with it in terms of exterior structures primarily. I mean,
yes.
There's obviously an interior practice that is going to be pretty key, because to some degree I would tend to accept her assumption that a certain amount of conflict, challenging and at least on the surface stressful conflict is going to be pretty hard to avoid.
Yeah, well, if you actually want to enter into the relationship, then the thing that we always have to do, which is so challenging, is somebody's upset, is to give us the experience that we hear them. You know, I get that you're upset.
Well, this is a parenting conflict. Did you get that?
I got co-parent. Co-parenting,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, believe me, I've dealt with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm saying that there's a certain way that you can kind of keep reminding someone that you actually care about how they feel. I'm just saying that sometimes can be helpful, depending on who it is. You know, that I care, that I'm hearing you. It's better for me if we don't do it this way. I do care. It matters to me that this matters to you. You have to repeat that kind of stuff a lot if you're going to actually engage.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
But it's a bit of an art without actually seeing how the energy is working and moving, because sometimes also putting a challenge down and saying, we can talk about this later, but I'm not going to talk about it if it's, you know, if it's going to have this quality. So call me when you calm down. Boom, hang up. You know, it depends a lot on where those openings are. You can't, there's no strategy. You have to use the art of both the receptivity of listening and validating and identifying along with the boundary setting and challenges. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Let me ask one of the, well, actually, we've got a live question. Let's bring in another voice.
Okay.
I think I know who this is. Is this Eric Troth? Hello.
Yes.
Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Terry. Hi, Diane. Good to be with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm feeling it activated myself. So there's a feistiness that I feel coming up right now, and you know I'm wanting to be skillful and offering something because you know I've been around both of you for a while, and I really deeply appreciate the work you're doing, and I appreciate the truth in what's expressed. And as we enter this land of paradox, there's that sense of you know how can we hold all of that and keep you know, making it bigger. And so, you know, as I listen, for instance, to that notion, Diane, about, you know, maybe this is, you know, the best that we can do, and I see that in each moment there are opportunities that, you know, we're missing so many of those that we need to be, you know, picking up on those. And I hear partly, I think, you know, Terry, this offering of there's got to be something more than that, this burr under our saddles. And, you know, and I'm sitting here listening, and I'm feeling that burr under my saddle that I don't know where to go with it, but I feel the energy of it, and that's what I'm wanting to bring in now. I don't know
what's
that
the,
I
what's
have
the
that.
Criticism? Let's just go right to let's just go to the criticism.
It's the why.
What's the criticism?
Why not? Yeah, it's like you know, not having illusions of some grandiose effect. Why not? Why not hold something? What is that part in us that wants to, you know, keep with our appearance of being, you know, rational and, you know, having a, you know, good integral sense of all this? I'm feeling this thing of like, you know, to hell with that. I want to feel into this greater possibility that I sense in me, that I feel that something's there, and I don't know how to make sense of it yet, but I know that there's something there that says, no, I don't accept that. I don't settle for that. I want something more, and I'm, you know, willing to drive a stake in the ground for that. I don't know that I can put a good intellectual point on that, but
that's
I'm
enough.
Speaking about
I
that,
think that's
the feeling
I mean,
of it in my
said,
gut.
What you said
yeah.
is really clear to me. Let me just reflect what I heard you say. So what I heard you say is I feel activated. The status quo of what you're saying isn't sufficient. I want more. I'm going to stand for it.
Yeah, that's it.
Well done. Well done. I mean, now I could somehow enter into that and start pushing that around, but it seems to me that you're just making a really strong statement about yourself and about what you want from your life, and from where I'm standing, that's a good thing. So I just don't have any issue with it. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's a funny way that because I'm talking about conflict, there's some sense that maybe we should have one. Mm-hmm. But you just made a really clear statement about what's true for you and how you differ from what I'm presenting, and that's just cool with me.
Thank you.
Well, you know,
go ahead, Jack.
I kind of feel like there's something that enters into the space here that we might be able to work a level deeper. You know, Eric's passion it's more raw than my own here, and it's I think it would be really instructive if Diane. You might, you know, on some level, Eric seems to be kind of saying, you know, like, or we might, I don't think he went so far as to say it, but I think that maybe an implication of what he brought forward might be, I really want there to be a bigger impact now, and I feel like others might maybe ought to feel the same way, and I'm trying to challenge you, Diane, to feel more that way, and you and I worked out a kind of version of this, but, you know, Eric's bringing it in a more raw form, and it might be interesting to see what can happen in terms of transmuting that energy here and now, if you're willing to go into it, Di. I think it might might be really valuable for everyone?
Well, you would have to facilitate me and give me some direction, because I'm not entirely sure what it is you're wanting me to do. Like this notion, this idea that people need to hold themselves to a greater standard around what they're doing in their lives, and that experience, you know, their waking up and participating with more urgency and more, you know, I mean, I seem to just kind of get polarized with that, where I'm sort of picking up the more chill side of the polarity. I mean, one side there's urgency, and on the other side, it's timeless. And where's all the urgency? And what are you even talking about? Like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. So I'm being a little bit challenging now. Like, go ahead and facilitate me, Terry. Like, give me some hard questions, like directly towards me, or help Eric do that or something. I don't know how to do it. So.
Well, you know, you can feel the wisdom in what Diane is saying, Eric. So the version of this conversation that's going to be really rich is going to be at the highest level possible. So what is left unsatisfied? Is there something more that you would want from her, or, you know, either want from her in terms of her own passion, or want from her in, as a possible teacher or exemplar to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I'm feeling in this moment, and I'm going to tie it back to something that was said earlier as a reference point of, you know, those three strategies of how do we deal with conflict. We, you know, we go away, or we find some way to accommodate, or we, you know, go into that challenge. And what I'm wondering right now, Diane, and I know that you often take the polarity, you go to the opposite, and it's great to play with those opposites, but then, you know, right now for me to, you know, raise my hand and speak up here on something that's being recorded and all that, it feels like a real challenge. It feels like I'm stepping out of myself more to go towards conflict and try to be a little more, you know, jabby with that. If you, Diane, go into kind of like, well, you know, I don't know what all this means and what, you know, it's kind of, it feels like a backing up to me. And so I have this desire to meet in that challenging way to see where we can play with the energy of that. Because what's going on in me is the energized part that I'm wanting to, I want to keep pressing into this because I care, damn it.
I just need it all to be more concrete, guys. It has to actually have some content, you know, like.
Content.
Yeah, like, you know, what do you want? I'm not sure what you're wanting from me. You know, I don't know what it is. So you're coming to me with, both of you are wanting something more from me, something different. And I might give it to you, I might not.
Yeah,
I just don't quite know what it
not.
Is.
Yeah.
You're wanting me to be more passionate. And
yeah.
Maybe I'm just going to say no.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yeah, because
I
don't.
You know what
really
comes
know
what,
how to
what
say
comes
yes.
up for me? Yeah. Okay.
I don't really know how to say yes.
Oh, cool. I mean, cool. Well, you know, staying with that. I mean, what I feel, just to speak, you know, my truth, because I know I've heard you, Diane, before. You're not interested in the grandiose theories. What's going on in me is like, I don't want to go to sleep after this. I don't want to hang up after an hour and a half of a beyond awakening thing that I, you know, made the point to be here with, and say like, oh, that was a nice call, and then it ends right there. I want something that's going to have some continuity.
All right, so let me
stir things up.
Okay?
Yeah.
As soon as you hang up, I want you to pick up the phone and call somebody that you've been kind of not very kind to. Pick up the phone, call them up, and say, you know what? I want to actually enhance the way I'm treating you and do it better. How about mm-hmm. that?
That's certainly.
How
a good
about
thing.
Actually, when you hang up, calling somebody that you are not having an easy time with? And saying to them, it's a struggle for me, I'm not good at it, but I'm willing to kind of put my heart on the line a little bit and try this out. To me, that has more reality to it, because it actually has to do with your life, the people in your life, how you're engaging the people in your life. And we don't have any real subject matter other than just the content of this call. And my guess is that, you know, you want it to go deeper, Terry wants it to go deeper, but the fact is, we don't have a lot that we're disputing about, so we just have to be real about that. You know, I can't make it up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So my direction to you would be to actually, you know, take the what you've heard on the call that's been useful and apply it in a moment in your own life
mm-hmm.
with the people that you actually live and love and work with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's okay. Where my challenge would be.
Challenge accepted. Okay. On one level, I think on an interpersonal level, to pick a person that I've had a conflict with and call them up and say, okay, let's work on that. Okay.
Yep.
Check mark. Got that one. I'm wanting to take it another step, though. I mean, and this is partly me pushing myself as I try to put initiatives out there that
draw people. But what
if
other
people
have
in.
But Eric, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Carrie, I actually would like to get another couple of questions before I get off the line, just in
yeah,
case there's
for
some
sure.
practical things I
okay.
can help people with.
Well,
fair
enough. Okay. We have relatively few people have actually written in questions, and last time I checked, Eric's hand was the only hand up, and I think this is kind of juicy.
Okay.
So I'm inclined. Oh, we've got another hand up immediately. let me offer one little piece here at the I feel like there's potentially a little rub or conflict even between you and Eric on this. I'm feeling the fact that we're all pondering this in different dispositions, and that it's asking something more of all of us, is kind of sweet. You know, like there's something in the perturbation of the field that we're enacting in having this conversation that's an expression of our situation. You know, like Diane, your spaciousness and your ability to hold all of these perspectives in such a, I think, a beautiful and clear way, is challenged by the passion that Eric and I have expressed in different respects, and therefore
you guys know me. You know that I'm a much bigger hothead than either one of you.
I do that.
So, you know, if we can find something to fight about, you know very well I will. Not that I'm not that I'm shy of having a conflict, you know, because I will.
Yeah,
but
totally.
I just don't genuinely feel one. I feel like, yeah, like do more, be better, go deeper. But without much content, I just don't know how to do that. I feel a little bit like I'm just kind of putting something on. I'm just being honest about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I hear what you're saying.
I just don't
have a response to it other than, you know, amen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that mostly feels complete to me. What I want to just witness as an observation is there is a burr under the blanket in general. And how we work with it, like everybody's version of how to work with it, is provisional and ready to be revised. And me being passionate and Eric being roused by it and you, Diane, helping us to see so many perspectives in a spacious way are all part of that. And we're all provoked to improve and refine and evolve our disposition and our perspectives and our ability to show up freely and radically in the present moment. All of that is in play right now. And it's asking each of us to show up, you know, like it's kind of a reminder that we're all in process. So, whoa, it's really alive. And I feel like that's an expression of the vitality and aliveness of this community and of all of us who are participating in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. But, I mean, you know, kind of, I mean, in a certain way we're addressing different dimensions of our experience in a way, because in a way what I hear you guys talking about, maybe more you, Terry, than you, Eric, is, you know, really wanting to let the challenges that we're faced with invigorate more, a deeper level of commitment, more urgency and more passion around your capacity to show up and really be available to what we're being challenged by. And for me, you know, the work that I did in this particular book just simply has to do with when we're working on a daily basis, we're working on programs together, we're collaborating, we're dealing with our spouse, we're doing whatever, just all the little ways that we don't really engage energetically with each other, and we avoid that engagement. And I'm kind of encouraging everybody to be a little more willing to have the fight. So you guys are, you know, saying to me, you know, well, let's have the fight. And I'm happy to have it. I just don't know where it is. I just don't know what the fight is.
I don't think it's the fight. I think it's just like we're saying that the field is quickened, and it's quickened for us, and we're wanting that to be felt, and we're hoping that presencing our own experience of it will quicken others.
Yeah,
I want to call on Bob Rao now from Wayne, Michigan.
Okay.
Hello.
Oh, wow. Well, that was quick. Hey, Terry and Diane.
Hi.
I'm appreciating having the fight, though. I just feel like a real hothead and a little bit of a pothead. And
a pothead and
weird,
a hothead?
Just, both at the same time, you know. But I have a card, so it's okay. But I feel like the heat that was coming up when Eric was talking and just all of it, you know, turned really cool. When there was a time when there was a little bit of release, a little bit of relief, and we had time to regroup. I mean, literally, the we that's greater sort of had time to regroup as the big mind. And I've been thinking a lot about how to have these dynamic environments where we have the green, you know, and we use that medicinal green that we might even all visualize somehow as to, like, have that cool, really cool space where all this heat can come up and we can really understand how to work with the conflict instead of it all just going all over the place and us not really understanding how to use the medicines that are available and to appreciate how to respectfully then request after that's been done how to work with medicines that may not be available. And maybe the medicine's already within us to some degree, but it's just like TM, it's very expensive. You know, so I'm just rambling, but I appreciate the call tonight, and I appreciate the conflict, and maybe we'll appreciate the integral living room coming up, but that's, I don't know. I'm going to have to discuss that with you guys.
Are
maybe
you
off the record. What do you think? How you feeling? Big mind.
I'm feeling good. How are you doing? Are you stoned?
Okay.
Self-disclosure, I don't know. We're still real shy about that, apparently.
Yeah, that's true.
Well,
but off the record, we'll get together and we'll talk about the meeting because it feels very, I'm very enthusiastic about it. But I got to get, you know, some things straight personally. And I don't know if I'm just being weird or what right now. Seriously.
Okay, well, thanks,
Carrie.
Sam. I appreciate your
call. I know
call.
You're nervous.
Your help. All right. Okay.
You know, I worked on a big dispute a couple of years ago. The fraternities up by the University of Utah. It's basically a bad structure up there. They have a zoning where they've got these expensive houses right next to the fraternities and sororities. So you have these people who work all day and want to sleep at night, living right next to people who sleep all day and party all night. So I was brought in to sort of help with this conflict. And believe it or not, one of the people who lived in the houses, one of the you know, more wealthy neighbors, said basically what he wanted to do to help with this conflict is he wanted to go back to the late 60s and early 70s when the fraternities were smoking a lot of dope, he said, because they were just a lot quieter then. So you're talking about a certain medicine I've actually heard people say that's what we need to use. So.
There you go.
Anyway, it's funny.
Okay, well, Nancy in Minneapolis has written actually a longish. She typed in several questions that are quite rich. So let me read those. Listening to the conversation and having read Terry's paper from the ITC, I have the same feeling of urgency as Terry. I also am new to integral theory and we space, and I'm seeing its importance to the solution to the meta crisis you've discussed. I very much want the we spaces to help us be more, and I do think we need to push ourselves because it's too easy to fall back on denial. I would like to help create we spaces which are in the midst of the current Genjo Koan, learning and growing by doing. My question is, how can we create some new forms of structures, lower right structures, to support our lower left we space? And then to add some more, I get the feeling, listening to these integral conversations, that people have spent so much time working in the upper quadrants, I and my behavior, that there does need to be a leap and a spur to get going in the lower quadrants, the we space and the it space, if we're going to bring integral consciousness into the world and make a big leap here, and that the shadow of the integral movement is our not knowing how to move into that, and our ability to work for the good of humanity being kind of stifled there. So she's presencing all that and kind of asking a question about how can, and I think in a way you're kind of an expert on structures that affect the lower left. It might be possible for you to really lean into that one.
Well, I think that the very fact that we can use structures, or that we should become conscious of the structures that we are using. I mean, most of the time when we come into a conversation, or we come into a work meeting, or we come into a decision-making process, we just simply use the structures that we've been given without ever really taking note of what they are. You know, so for instance, majority rule, you know, like we're going to vote on something. Well, is that the rule we want to use? Would we rather use consensus? Would we rather talk for 3 hours and finally arrive at a decision that just spontaneously emerges? Like, what I would suggest, just in terms of this question about creating structures, I don't know how many new structures need creating. Like I mentioned Truth and Reconciliation and how it emerged as a response to those particular conditions. But I think just becoming conscious of what the group structures are that are in place. Are you using turn-taking in your conversations? Would you rather, like, maybe try interrupting each other and talking simultaneously like some cultures do? Like, not everybody uses turn-taking. Turn-taking is a very particular kind of dialogic device that not everybody uses. Like, what are the structures that are in place? Are they the ones that we want? What would happen if we did something completely differently? You know, when you sit down at dinner with your kids, you know, rather than just having a casual conversation, what would happen if we all took turns focusing on each person and presented them with a question? Or what would happen if we, you know, what's another kind of creative thing that we want to do? What would happen if you split your family up into teams and inquired of one another what happened during the day? I mean, there are all kinds of creative, interesting ways to structure group space. And I think that, A, becoming aware of what structures are in place, B, creating new ones just in order to play around and experiment, and C, seeing what you learn. So that would be my response to that question is, you know, in your life, you know, take some opportunities to try some new stuff and just see how it works. That's what we're going to be doing at the Integral Living Room. We're going to use probably 4 or 5 different methodologies for having conversations, seeing which ones actually work, which ones do we like, which ones allow us to go deeper in the way that Eric and Terry were, you know, which ones bring up a sense of urgency and passion. So, you know, we're nothing if not creative, but we have to pay attention to what we are doing before we can create some new way of being. So that's my response to that question. What do you think, Terry? I'm interested in your point of view with the paper you've just written.
Well, I do think that innovating on what we do is key. In my paper, I talk about a number of key practices. I think that there need to be so many different passionate conversations in which we actually presume that we can make a difference, and we get not edgy in the sense of getting worked up or getting into an overwrought tone necessarily, but in which we really just never say die. We just keep being unwilling to expect that the next conversation will not exceed the last. We keep entering in with a sense of possibility and a passion to and a kind of hunch that something new is possible. It's as if there's a strange attractor of a breakthrough that's wanting to find its way in. Just like, you know, as the heat builds up in the ocean, a hurricane may want to happen, but it takes that butterfly wing flapping on the other side of the globe to catalyze it. Mm-hmm. And there's something that's wanting to happen here that's positive. There is a creative leap to a higher order that's possible. And I really want to beat my butterfly wings with, you know, the rest of my life with real passion. And so there are structures that we can innovate, we can engage with, we can do what we can to catalyze really intelligent people to engage in this spirit of that can-do kind of attitude that something can really transform. I think there are some very specific and kind of more elaborate things that I wrote about in more detail in my paper that you know, have to do with going from a third-person perspective to a first, to a second, that have to do with really speaking at a level of passion, really indenturing ourselves, that is really apprenticing ourselves to a course of development that can enable us to get into this more richly. But, you know, I'm clearer about the passion and intensity and integrity with which I need to hold the questions than I am about the answers.
Yeah, well, I'm relatively confident around. I don't know what the answers are, but I certainly know that they're. You know, I'm teaching this integral facilitator course. I'm doing this one in Houston in September, where just teaching people how to be present, how to work with the questions in the field, how to hold the energy, how to heighten conflict in order to capture energy, how to resolve it, how to use creative forms. You know, there are. Skills involved in, you know, actually making ourselves available to, you know, whatever the dialogic challenges are, whatever the we space challenges are, you know, like we can, you can actually bring yourself to a conversation that's more enlivening, has more insight, and leaves people, you know, really wanting to participate in the way that you're talking about just simply by how you're interacting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would just encourage everybody who's listening to take your challenge and to, you know, to lean into what ways you might become more fully present. You might hold yourself to a higher standard, and you might actually start working with some forms that will make a difference to people. You know, make yourself useful, so to speak.
Okay. Well, that may be the perfect note for us to finish on. We're out of time. And that's a good point. I love you, Di. This is a rich and rough and bumpy and, you know, warts and all. We're throwing ourselves into this, and I. But I'm going to tell everybody what's coming next session in September in a minute, and a few reminders first. If you value what you're receiving here, please let others know about it. They can register for this series at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com. If you want to learn more about Diane and her work, please pre-order her book. Also, go to DianeMushelHamilton.com and TwoArrowsZen.org. The Integral Living Room is really the place to really get into all this in the richest possible way, and that'll be October 31st through November 2nd. Go to IntegralLivingRoom.com, and you're also invited to go to TerryPatton.com. And get on my mailing list. The next Beyond Awakening interview is going to be on Sunday, September 8th, with the meditation teacher Kenneth Folk, the innovator of a pragmatic approach to intersubjective awakening. It's going to be called Awakening is Possible, But So What? Thank you so much for joining Diane and me today. Thank you so much, Diane, for being here and for being you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Terry. Thanks, everybody who's been on the call. I really appreciate it. Bye, Terry.
Bye-bye.
Love you. See you later. Bye.